welcome to the Inside Myanmar podcast. Before we get into today's show, I want to let you know that we have a lot more written and video content on our website. If you haven't visited it yet, we invite you to take a look at insightmyanmar.org. In addition to complete information about all of our past podcast episodes, there's also a variety of blogs, books, and videos to check out. And we also encourage you to sign up for our monthly newsletter. But for now, enjoy what follows, and remember, sharing is caring. Kiet Sithi Yarman, thank you for joining us on this episode of Inside Myanmar Podcast.
Pleasure, it's all mine.
You have had quite a distinguished career in addition to everything else I'm about to mention. I just learned moments before recording that you did everything from building power plants to playing trumpet in a brass band. But in addition to that, and on a more serious note, you have also been quite involved in any number of progressive policies domestically within Thailand, as well as overseeing some aspects in the recent past of Thailand's engagement with the international community. And that certainly involves Myanmar and Thai-Burmese relations, as we'll get into in the interview that follows. But I would first like to invite you to introduce your own background, as we'll get to see. And as I saw as I was reviewing this, it's quite extensive. So I'd like to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself to our audience and get to know you.
Well, thank you very much for this interview and for allowing me to talk about myself briefly. I started off my career as an electrical engineer. You know, my expertise is in extra high voltage area. So building power plants is quite natural. And I managed to get the work with the French multinationals based in Grenoble, France, since 1982, and worked with them for a good 10, 12 years. And working in various locations worldwide, in France itself, in Malaysia, in Singapore, in Indonesia, in many countries in the region, and also in briefly in Abu Dhabi, Middle East. And after that, I came back, still in private sector. And then I was dragged into politics by accident, because I went to invite the prime minister at the time when we had the economic crisis. I was director of the Board of Trade of Thailand. So I went to the parliament, but also to the prime minister's office in order to invite him to speak with the private sector. And then I was interviewed. Like, you know, I've done quite a few extensive work at that time internationally. So he asked me to help managing, being his advisor, to help find the best way to deal with the crisis, financial crisis of 1997. So that's how I got involved with politics. He appointed me as prime minister advisor a few months after that. And then after that, he asked me to run for the office. So I ended up 3 terms in as member of parliament and 1 term as deputy prime minister doing trade negotiation for the country worldwide. And when I was in the private sector, I was also instrumental in setting up the International Chamber of Commerce Thailand chapter so that the private sector in Thailand would have stage international stage to voice that, to have a voice, to have that, to be able to voice that concern among the international trade communities. So we have set up International Chamber of Commerce in Thailand as well.
I can only imagine what a transition that would have been from going from the private sector into the halls of power, advising a head of state and being a member of parliament and taking your knowledge of industry and helping to do your part as Thailand was in a crisis at that point, but then charting trade and another knowledge that you had from your professional background and bringing it into public service. So can you talk for a moment about what you remember about that transition and what it was like to find yourself in that new role?
It was completely different ballgame. Mm. Everything was new. But if your mind is clear as to what your objectives are, you don't get confused. So I'm there to do something which I believe is good for the country. And I try to reflect all of my experiences internationally and also locally so that it helps out it can help with the mitigating the crisis that we have faced. And along the way, I learned also that being in politics is a different ballgame, absolutely different ballgame. Mm. It took me a while to get used to it, but still, if you're there for a good reason, for the right reason, you don't get confused. If you're there, not for yourself, for the greater good, for the best interest of the country, then you don't get confused. Mm-hmm. So my role at the time, with my international experience in public and private sector, I also tried to introduce some good policies for the country. And later on, when I was involved with, I was Deputy Prime Minister in 2009, I was the one who initiated the Thai-EU Free Trade Agreement. I concluded Thai-Chile Free Trade Agreement. Thai-Peru, Latin America, continent is very far, but significant, important. Yeah. So I concluded that, introduced many more. I was also a member of the vision group to map out how ASEAN would engage with China, Korea, and Japan in 2001. And map out so that it became regional asset as we know it today. It's a regional hub of free trade agreement plus six, ASEAN plus China, Korea, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and India. So I was very much involved with many of that.
This was certainly a time that you're referencing that you were most involved of tremendous growth in Thailand. And the Thailand that we see today is really the result of a lot of the development that happened during that time. And so it's interesting to be able to speak to someone who played a role in that development process behind the scenes or in the front in some cases. As that was happening. And I appreciate, and I bookmarked the phrase, you talk about not being confused. I think that's very significant, and it's something I think to hold on to going forward as we look at cases where moral confusion does play a role. And as you were talking, I couldn't help but chuckle to myself, am I having a conversation with that oxymoron of an honest politician? and so I want to ask you if you can describe confusion is a very charged word. I'd like to ask you to unpack what you mean, but because when you mentioned that, I think you must be referring to the example of seeing others who were confused and did get confused. And by contrast, you were sticking to a moral path where you were clear in your objectives and aspirations. So if you could unpack what you mean by that confusion and how you were able to steer clear of it.
Absolutely. I'm glad you asked that, because I entered politics at the time when Khun Chuan Lik Pai was the prime minister. And he's known. He's probably the longest standing elected member of parliament ever. He was the only one that has been elected a prime minister twice. Chairman of the parliament three times in one's life. Okay, he's now 80 something, but he's still going strong. He's an honest politician, and I'm glad I was involved with him. But since then, I was involved in politics, both locally and internationally. And I met so many politicians, the good ones and the bad one and the confused one. Okay, so definitely I've seen that. But I don't allow myself to get confused as to why I'm in politics. You know, and there are lots of people that once they get into power, once they get into their role as member of parliament or others, they can be very confusing. And they can be actually allowing themselves not to be the best they can be. For poor reasons, maybe. You know, I've been through a lot. I did a lot of check and balance. When I was working in parliament, I scrutinized all the deals when in opposition. And as a result, many of the politicians, the dishonest one, actually have to pay back to this country more than 60 billion baht because of my work. I'm proud of that, and I would not change a thing. Despite difficulties in living my life, after all the things I've done, you can imagine all the intimidations, all the all kinds of offers, you know, which is so hard to refuse for most, but not if you're not confused. If you're not confused, you understand what you're doing for. And as Secretary General to Council of Asian Liberals and Democrats, and also Vice President of Liberal International for 4 years, I always speak to the newer generation, younger generation of politicians. I said, well, if you cannot withstand all these fancy proposals, although it's all wrong, don't get involved with politics. That's my message to the younger generation. I said, there is no room. I don't like to see the room for bad politicians, okay? Because public interest is very important, extremely important. And even, it's not about, it's about ideas. It's about good ideas. You know, there are lots of policy, good policy, that doesn't even require a budget. So those politicians who came out and start excusing themselves that, oh, we don't have enough money to do this and that, it's all bullshit. I'm sorry for my language. But, you know, there are lots of good policies that does not require any money at all. But yet, so many countries chose not to. So many governments chose not to. So many politicians chose not to because they're not prepared to fight against the bad influence. And if you're not prepared to do that, don't be in politics. Sorry.
Right.
That's my view.
Yeah, I think it's something of human nature that whether it's politics or whatever else, when we, when one finds oneself in a position of influence, of possibility, you find out who you really are in those moments when those opportunities come. And that certainly transcends culture. I mean, corruption and making bad decisions and using influence the wrong way. Certainly, there's no country or society in the world that's immune to that. I'm wondering, in your case, where did that clear moral vision come from? Was it religious? Was it from your family? Was it something in your character? Where did that arise from? And then how would you describe, you mentioned your lack of confusion. What was the opposite of that lack of confusion? What was the clear direction that you would define that you would not be swayed from?
I just said to myself, I want to look at myself in the mirror every night and feel happy about it, about that guy that I saw in the mirror. Where it came from, hard to tell. But I was brought up, I have very harsh childhood, difficult. I have to make a living since the age of 15, 16. I have to find the money to pay for my food and my education already. And that's why I said there is a free lunch is never good. You have to work for it. So you're proud that you work for it, you know, and you earned it. You make sure you earned it in everything you do. And maybe it started with that. And working internationally, actually, I was offered along the way all the time, okay? I went to build power plants in Malaysia. I have to place huge orders for local materials. Mm. And the guy just saying, you know, take this because it's part of our culture. It's okay. Mm. I said, no, it's not. Mm. Give us an additional discount. And I discovered that actually in so doing, I gained so much credit with the Home Office.
Yeah.
And it's best for the project that I manage, and it's my reputation. So I enjoy doing the right thing. Mm. Maybe because I'm not greedy. I don't know.
No, that's beautiful. I think that combines kind of a personal moral way of life with public service and with being able to do right for a company or for a government or for people or society. And so that moves us into your role in the public sector, where you were involved not just in the domestic issues that were going on in Thailand, and you were a progressive force there to any number of issues and controversies that came up. But as you've already mentioned, you started to become involved in the international sector, not just with trade deals, but also with some engagement with ASEAN towards Japan, Korea, and China. And so I'd like to prompt you to speak a bit about when you started to represent Thailand internationally and some of the activities you were involved with there.
For the best interest of the country, obviously. And I saw so many potential, great potential that has not been exploited yet. Mm. Having experience in international trade in the private sector as a director of ICC, International Chamber of Commerce, based in Paris. So I like to see Thailand engaging more internationally. So when I got the opportunity, when I was in the office, then I made sure I said to myself, what am I going to do so that it's something different, something new, something never done before. Mm. So I basically started to open up the market in Middle East, which no government has done that before. Mm-hmm. It's difficult, but not beyond your ability or the ability of a country. If you understand well why they need to have you as partner. So doing homework, it's crucial, extremely important. So at the time, I managed to strike the deal with Bahrain, which very few countries in this region pay attention to because they're small, but they're really geographically, strategically located. Mm. They need what we have. So we strike the deal on setting up food security stockpile in Bahrain for the whole region of the Gulf. Mm. And in 6 months, we signed the deal. Mm-hmm. That's 35 billion baht. Mm. And I saw the opportunities as an engineer by training. I saw the opportunity for Thai construction industry, which is very advanced as compared to the rest in the region. So I managed to take them to open up to various markets internationally. And I recorded 150 billion baht worth of deals in new market. That's never been done before. So I'm proud of what I did.
That's quite a bit. And looking several decades on now from the time that you were involved in that, it's always hard to be able to connect direct threads and cause and effect of those policies. But are there, when you look at Thailand's current development heading into 2026, are there aspects of what you put together then that you could point to a trajectory of where Thailand is at today as a result of that?
We could have done more. Definitely. There's no doubt in my mind. Thailand do not deserve to be a low-growth country. as we did in the past several years. We could have been in the range of 5 to 6% GDP growth every year if we choose the right policy for the country. But we need united government. You need, you know, unity. You need bad politics does not allow country to move on as best as they can. So it happens, not just in Thailand. Mm-hmm. In many countries in Europe, they have been there before, several countries, not just one. That's the price you pay for not understanding the root of the word democracy. Mm-hmm. Freedom is one thing, mm-hmm. but doing the right thing based on potential of the country is another. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, those get elected are the popular faces, but not the one that is most able to do the job for the country, unfortunately.
It's interesting that you use the word democracy here in a conversation where we're talking about economic growth and development. And so that brings up a question of where these two fit together, where when we're looking at economic growth, free trade, being able to have connections with other countries that are not necessarily traditional partners, this whole work that you did, and then the conversation of what it means to have a real democracy. So I'd like to hear where you connect those two concepts.
When I was 4 years with Liberal International as with our vice president, I managed to do two things, which I'm proud of and still there today, is a change of the manifesto of the Liberal International. One is the word freedom. There's no freedom without limits. You cannot intimidate the high belief. You cannot make fun of religious belief. Mm-hmm. You should never do that. Mm-hmm. That's ultimate human being and their beliefs. Mm-hmm. And you cannot, as much as you like to, prove that your thought is all correct, so that you intimidate other religions, other religious beliefs, you should never do that. So there is that element in the new manifesto. Secondly, as I'm being involved with trade, and I've seen more than enough of bad trade practices, mm-hmm. and unfair trade practices, mm-hmm. and I said, I don't use the word free trade. I use the word trade liberalization. Mm-hmm. Even International Chamber of Commerce, they never use free trade.
I see.
They use trade liberalization. Mm-hmm. So I managed to convince all my colleagues at Liberal International to change the manifesto that we should aspire to free and fair trade. Mm-hmm. When you insert the word fair, it changed completely the game.
Right.
It means that in the circumstance where the market mechanism do not work, mm-hmm. you have to intervene mm-hmm. to make sure it's fair. Mm-hmm. And that is very important. I've seen being in private sector with multinationals, I've seen global collusion before. Mm-hmm. Okay. That shouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. But okay, because of all of that, I'm proud with what we have accomplished in 4 years. And this changed completely the way people think about trade. Mm. Fair is extremely important. Give you a very simple question, a simple example. Oil business. Okay? There are only a few countries that has oil reserves. Okay? And they can produce oil. At first, they don't want to even be part of WTO. Because they cannot sit down together and discuss price. Mm-hmm. This is a price agreement. And they can do that. They can do anything they want. So getting them into WTO is much better to have the forum to engage with them. Mm-hmm. So they follow a certain rules, although they can break it because it's only a few countries that can sit down and discuss on price. That's the ultimate collusion. Mm-hmm. So where's free trade? It's not, there is no market mechanism that would dictate the price.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
So there are so many circumstances like that. Only a few producer in the world. And we have to be very careful that we make sure that people like you and me would benefit from the best agreements, international agreement they can, with the right kind of policy.
Yeah.
And fair trade is extremely important.
Yeah. So hearing that from you, it definitely appears that you're a believer in a rules-based system, in an international global community that's able to come together, to speak to one another, to work out agreements, so whether it's in trade or foreign policy or alliances or other kinds. And so, in the world that we're moving into today, it's been commented on more frequently the dangers of how we're moving away from that rules-based global order that really dominated the 1990s and beyond. And so from your perspective in the past endeavors you've been involved in and from sitting here in Thailand, where do you see the current state of the world and where it's going? Are you worried? Do you think that this is just a small blip that will correct itself out soon enough? Or do you have serious concerns?
We are not moving away from institution. Trump, move away.
Yeah, right.
United States, move away. Okay? Well, the rest of the world didn't agree with that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But because they used the size of their economy and their political pull in security area to assert influence to make sure they get the best benefit from it. That's very unfortunate because the United States, along with many countries, including Thailand, we worked together to set up WTO.
Yeah.
We're the one who set up, who strike the deal of GATT agreement, General Agreement on Trade Tariffs. So it's unfortunate that the United States, under this current administration, chose that path. It will not be sustainable. I don't believe for a moment. And I think the whole community of WTO today, they are already implementing WTO minus one. And I welcome that.
Mm.
If anyone, big or small, try to break the rules, that's already proven that it's in the best interest of human beings nationwide, worldwide.
Yeah.
Then those like-minded have to work together. And on that note, it's surprising that, the country like China, who closed the country for decades, now more than ever trying to promote multilateral agreement. And I think the whole EU is extremely concerned about the current status of trade. But they have to play ball. Everyone has to play ball to continue. But I don't believe for a moment that everyone thought this could last or this could be the new regime.
Mm.
I don't think so.
So you don't have fear about that?
I have concern. I would not use the word fear. But I would encourage everyone on this planet Earth to work together to fight against it because it's uncalled for. And just remember this. The reason we don't see the big impact in the US this year, you know why? Because everybody, when they heard about these tariff things, they stock up the goods that is needed. So the cost is not yet passed on to the Americans.
Yeah.
But it will be. Next year, the stock is dried up. All the consumable items dried up. They have to place new orders and it will be different price. And it's the price that is not paid by the exporter is paid by the American people. And that's when they will feel the heat. And politics cannot sustain without the people not supporting anything, any policy that give their lives hell. Mm-hmm. Increasing their costs of living mm-hmm. is impossible.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, we can't talk about the concerns about a weakening of global rule of law without talking about how the international community has engaged with the crisis in Myanmar since 2021, or even if we want to go back the last several decades in terms of how they have engaged or not engaged effectively there, whether we're talking about the various missions of the United Nations or we're talking about ASEAN. There are two different sets of conversations here. There's the set of there's the conversation about the inside track as to what's happening, sometimes confidentially, privately, according to the formal protocols and channels that have to exist within those organizations. And then there's the public perception, which is quite critical and seems like these organizations are doing practically nothing as, you know, the crisis continues to worsen. And certainly that's the case since after 2021. But, you know, from your time in office, decades ago, Myanmar has always been a very serious case of atrocities and human rights violations and many other things. And so using that perspective of your comfort and your preference for this rules-based order, for multilateral agreements, for international coalitions, what is your view on how those international systems in the past, as you were more involved, as well as today, as you're following along, how you've seen them engage in Myanmar?
Many of them, they care about what they say more than the results that they would get, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Yeah.
And many, which I understand, okay? You're in politics, you're in political office. You have to make a certain statement, you know, voicing concern or preaching the principle that everyone should adhere to. I understand all that. But I like also to see that everyone moves through the right level of engagement. And unfortunately, not every country can afford the time, also the attention to what's happening, like, 1,000 miles away from home. They're not monitoring it every day. You're not, you know, so that's what happened. So you have different levels of engagement with the country. Now, when all else failed, you said, okay, let's do sanction. But sanction with the dictator government or military government doesn't really help because they don't really feel too attached to the people that is suffering.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
That's what happened worldwide. Mm-hmm. But we also see many countries having double standards in doing that. If it's the country that is they're having such a huge interest with, they tend to not flexing much muscle and engage more in different manners. I've seen that directly with some countries in Europe. And I remind them that, hey, you need to walk the talks. You cannot do certain things with exceptions.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things that I can give you. If you give me 3 hours, I can give you real life examples of double standard that people are doing, some for good reasons, some for crazy reasons. But in case of Myanmar, the one thing that Thailand, as a country, we have done, we are the receiving end of what happened to the people of Myanmar. And I feel bad for them. Every time there is a spillover effect, Thailand always, always taking pride in helping out. There's never one exception. Okay? Although those countries who pressure Thailand to do that promise that they will play their part, either monetary support or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you'll be surprised. I have the list of the countries that even do not live up to their promises.
Yeah.
And there are not a small ones.
Yeah.
There are big ones too. Mm-hmm. And that happened even the case of Cambodia, even Khmer Rouge at the time. Thailand took the refugees who's been in our country for decades. And everyone already forgot about their responsibility or their chair responsibility to help out. So that's so many of that. The world's not, it's far from perfect. I understand all that. But Thailand, at least, we play without failure, you know, as the receiving end for those who cannot continue to live happily in their home country, in the nearby area, or even further. But we also discover that once the disruption of their life is over, they also choose to go back. Mm-hmm. I was with the House Committee on Foreign Affairs when I was in the office 6 years ago. We also play that role, and we discuss with some people directly, like, what do you want to do? You want to go to the third country? What do you want to do? But once the airstrike stops, once the military move out of the region, mm-hmm. they said, I want to go home.
Right, right.
And we support them
yeah.
in so doing. So, and I would say those who actually voice the concern have not done enough to share the responsibility. Mm. And I like to see that more. Not just talking about atrocity, but not doing what they can mm-hmm. to help out. Mm-hmm. Because this is not Thailand's problem. This is international community's
sure.
problem.
Sure. I think that's very true. And earlier this year, I was in Europe and spent some time in the Nordic countries, particularly in Sweden and Norway, and spoke to many people there that were openly critical of their government, as you say, making those promises and then not doing enough to relieve the situation in Thailand, while sometimes criticizing the way it was being handled, but not fulfilling, as you say, either monetarily or through some other means or taking them into their countries, that those processes were slower than they would have liked because the proximity was not there, as in Thailand's case. So I think that's definitely one part of the story. Another part of the story, of course, is that Thailand is not a signatory of the 1951 Refugee Convention, and so does not recognize refugees as such. And so, with those bigger countries, notwithstanding their unfulfilled promises that they made and the greater burden that's been placed on Thailand as a result of that, that being acknowledged and certainly being a factor that we need to recognize and that has its place. That being said, looking at the overflow of the successive conflicts in Myanmar, and especially after the 2021 coup, what are your thoughts or comments on how Thailand has responded to that? Do you believe that there's more they could have done, or that there's policies that would have been more helpful, or do you really think, given those situations and conditions, they were really doing the best they could at each time?
Because you cite the fact that we're not part of certain convention or agreement, does not mean that we stop doing what we need to do to help out human beings, refugees. Just to say that Thailand do not recognize refugees is wrong. It's proven. We have foreign ministries working with the UN, having a long list of refugees. I can tell you from my personal experience on that, we have had several requests from some countries in the region to send back certain refugees to their home country to be prosecuted. I refused. And I was one of a few member of parliament who totally against that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I check all the facts with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Do we have clear lists by the UN of refugees stationed in this country? Yes, we do. And I work with that list. And I stop the authorities from, or even friends of our neighbors, to take advantage of, you know, situation with some refugees. Mm-hmm. I've done that. We've done that. And Thailand never failed to do that. We practice non-refoulement. Mm-hmm. Okay? Clearly. In all circumstances. Mm. With or without help from international community or the UN. We've done that. Yeah, we're not perfect. There were cases where we have not, some department, government department, do not work together, so they on the same wavelength. Mm-hmm. It happens. Mm-hmm. But once I was told by several members of liberals and Democrats in the region, I took action. I didn't even have to be in the administrative side to do that. Even as member of parliament, I can do it. And I have full cooperation of all the officers, police and military. Mm-hmm. So there is no reluctance on Thailand's part to play that role, regardless of whatever agreement we might have had with any organizations. Mm-hmm. I can assure you on that,
right,
from personal experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Now, looking deeper into the Myanmar crisis, there's, especially after 2021, but I think this has been true in previous decades, there has been a preference, I guess we could say, among the international community to look at ASEAN and neighboring countries as a way to engage or resolve or talk to negotiate with the military, that there were more commonalities of culture and of background to be able to get through to them. And you know, I think that this Burmese military, whether we're looking at this current incarnation or previous decades, they, to put it lightly, I think it's an understatement to say they are certainly not the easiest people to try to get through to, or to try to make them understand, or to change their behavior. So I'm curious, in your positions of when you were in an official capacity, did you have interactions with senior members of the Burmese military? Did you engage with them? And what can you, if so, what could you share about the way those conversations went and what impressions you had?
I have engagement when, Aung San Suu Kyi was under house arrest. Mm. At that time, I was not in political office. It was a situation in Thailand with drafting constitution. So I went, I tried to get to Myanmar to visit Aung San at the house. At first, I was encouraged by the government, military government, not to do so. Mm. But with very little insistence on my part, I go. I managed to go with one of the former Prime Minister, Kunaphisit. At the time, he was not yet the Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. So we went to visit her, and we have several other trips under Council of Asian Liberals and Democrats. And we met with several people, President of Parliament, who was later on involved with a number of things, part of the military government that took over. We met some of them. We still believe that engaging is more useful than not engaging. Lots of countries chose to disengage, mm-hmm, and imposing sanctions and all of that. I think in case of Myanmar, we have proven, ASEAN has proven, that engaging with Myanmar do more good than harm. And that was the result of the previous elections, through engagement, through pressure from many countries working together in the same direction. Now, in this current situation, most countries, some big countries, put it this way, think making a statement or doing a little bit of sanction is good enough. It's not. What can they do more? I think they forgot about one of the most important countries that have tremendous influence with Myanmar today. And I advised, when I was in the office, to every ministerial position delegates that they need to get China on the side. We need to work with China in order to map out in the same direction about the future of democracy in Myanmar. With the support of China and Russia, you can only see results.
Do you think there's enough common ground between where China and Russia would be engaged and
there is enough common objectives.
What would those be?
To have a country in good order. Mm-hmm. And it would benefit everybody. In good order, it means whatever order that acceptable by the people. Mm-hmm. And we get to the election as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. So the people can choose their future.
The people would certainly not choose the military, and so the question would be, how would China and Russia then feel about that? Would there be enough common ground for the people not to choose the military as part of their future going forward?
I don't think anyone in the right mind today are comfortable with a military government. But to go to another extreme, to say that it has to be democracy as we know it in the West is not going to happen. Sorry. It has to be the democracy that the people of Myanmar is satisfied, is happy enough to move forward. You need to support the people, not to support the right kind of government that you like.
Sure.
Okay? And that's a real democracy. Mm-hmm.
And what do you think is the best way to do that, to support the people that choose their own future?
To make sure that everyone is on the same page about the next election in Myanmar and how it should be organized, how the people would achieve the objectives of being at the ballot box. Mm-hmm. Not by design of some groups. Mm. That's good enough for most countries, big and small, to be on the same page.
Many in the resistance are calling this, I should say, so-called election as a sham election, a scam election, something that shouldn't be legitimized. ASEAN, as far as I've heard, is not sending observers to the election. What are your thoughts on the significance and the dangers, we could say, of this military proposed so-called election going forward?
This engaging is wrong. Not sending anyone is not something I would recommend. Okay? Everyone should help for the sake of the people, not for the sake of, you know, I don't like this, I don't like that. No. You get confused there. Everything we're trying to do, or even the system that we try to make sure that, you know, the country moves forward, has to be the system that people are ready to accept. So far, we just look from the outside. We're not engaging with the people.
When you say engaging with the people, which people exactly are you pointing to that should be engaged?
All groups. Mm-hmm. Regardless. But, you know, I think most country knows enough what is the best step forward that would achieve credibility of elected government and accepted by the people. But when we engage, I don't think we could have done more. I would say that we could have done more. And even the time before getting to this deadline, unfortunately, it is what it is, okay? We cannot change the past. We can only influence the future.
There's always this fear that engagement, whatever benefits engagement would bring, they also touch upon legitimization. And so where do you have a measure of engagement without tipping the scales to legitimization to an actor that's not seen as legitimate to their own people? How do you resolve or speak to that tension?
ASEAN has shown that the previous election, before the previous election, engagement is the answer. And the result was okay before.
2020.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it?
The 2020 election, which the military overturned. Is that what you're referring to? Yeah. So you're referring to the
when Aung San became in political office doing her job. And, you know, can't remember the name of the prime minister elected at that time. Okay. Through the process. Okay, not perfect, but much better and well accepted worldwide.
So then when the military overthrew the 2020 election in February 1st, 2021, how do you think that ASEAN and Thailand in particular should have responded in that moment?
I'm not going to comment on the past, okay? They've done what they did under very difficult circumstances. And I reserve my personal view on that. It is what it is. Otherwise, I would have said why the United States, they could have done more.
Certainly.
China could have done more. Russia could have done more. Not just about ASEAN. Everybody should have done more.
Yeah.
Okay? If we care enough about the well-being of the people. But sometimes we look at the form. If the form is right, it's okay, but not the substance. And there are so many cases in this world, democracy in so many countries, where the form was all correct, but the substance is all wrong. Why didn't we say anything about that?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't countries say anything about that? And we're now seeing one of the model of democracy of the world, largest, getting the results that is their intention? I don't think so. I don't think so.
So if we're looking, moving ahead, if we're looking at this point in time and we're looking for a way to prioritize substance over form and have the correct form of engagement, which is also, as I know, has been a value deeply rooted to you throughout your career, valuing human rights, valuing human dignity, valuing the right of free expression and people to choose their own leaders. We're looking at a resistance that is certainly less than free in Myanmar and around the world, that is being hunted down, arrested by the junta, that is undocumented in Thailand, that has any number of its own problems. And so, given the reality of those conditions and the reality of the military rule, which many Burmese themselves see as not legitimate, what would you suggest as a way forward for Thailand or ASEAN or the international community as a way to, in your words, you know, to talk to the people, to let the people make their choice? This is quite a complex undertaking in Myanmar to be able to figure out how to do that. So do you have thoughts as to how you would suggest proceeding in that case?
I was with the observer team for the first election in Indonesia. Okay. With Jimmy Carter at the time. I was with Khun Chuan, the two chair, as observer, international observer. We can send team of international observers to see if the election should be legitimate or not.
Mm-hmm.
but not engaging, we're blind. Mm-hmm. So why not? Mm-hmm. If they care enough, they should go see. Go take a look. Mm-hmm. And send the view to the world that in our view is fair or is not. If you see the influential people in front of the ballot box, take the picture, tell the world. That's one way that I know of, that I've done, I've been part of it. Mm. Still, I don't think people talk enough about it. Mm. There are lots of solutions, lots of possibilities, a lot of step forward that would help the country and the people of Myanmar to get what they deserve.
So then looking at this coming election, I think many have written it off as something that it's simply not possible to be free and fair for any number of conditions, some of them being the just how much of the country is under conflict and the difficulty in being able to conduct some kind of any kind of ballot in a place that is under the kind of violence that it's under, to say nothing of the freedom of different parties or individuals and being able to participate. So, but I just want to clarify what it sounds like you're suggesting is a wait and see, that it's worth going to look at how things are actually progressing on the ground and not to write it off, not to look at these conditions in advance and write it off before actually being able to go and engage directly in what one sees. Is that correct?
Why do we not engage with the whole process that lead up to this election more? By everyone who say they are concerned about it. You have to tell me that. So the word you just said that, okay, they don't believe. Those who said it, have they ever been to Myanmar? Tell me.
Well, I think these are a lot of Burmese democracy activists that are saying this.
That's fine. Mm.
There's a big push among many of the democratic leadership in the NUG, as well as resistance group, as well as ground activists. That
NUG is not happy, but they cannot be as. And what do they want others to help out in these circumstances? The other countries, if they mean well to Myanmar, I think engagement, I stress and stress again, engagement from the very beginning that would lead up to this. If they assert enough influence during the whole process of starting to the ballot box, perhaps we would have seen a different kind of atmosphere. Okay? I understand. Nuke is not given a complete, or the military government do not follow everything Nuke wish for. But is it good enough for next step? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm not close enough to even comment on it.
Sure.
But the one thing that I would say people can help, outsider can help, is to go in and witness what's going on. Mm-hmm. You can tell a lot. I can tell a lot. As, being through many elections in my life, mm-hmm. I went on the ground and I can tell, oh, this is rigged. Oh, this is no. Mm-hmm. I can tell. And if it's not right, then tell the world mm-hmm. with evidence, mm-hmm. not just bias, not opinion, evidence. So I think observer team, regardless of where we are today, is still extremely important.
Mm-hmm. Well, hypothetically speaking, would there ever be a situation where a so-called election was being held anywhere that would appear to be so rigged from the outset that it wouldn't even be worth sending an observer team? Or are you saying, do you believe that that it's whatever the circumstances, whatever kind of election would be held, it's always a good policy to have people on the ground and not to reject it outright.
Definitely.
I see, right?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. You know, as I mentioned, I've been through many elections in my life, okay? Successful ones for me or not successful one for me. And you can tell. If you're close enough to the ballot box, you can see whether there is a influential figure around. You can ask the people who went to the ballot box, hey, before you came here, have you received any visitors at home? There are lots of things you can do. And the monitoring team, if they have enough experience, they can do all that. And I've done all that during my time as the observer team.
Mm-hmm. And in the case of Myanmar, if an observer team were to go and were to find many examples of a rigged and unfair election, what then?
Give a scientific conclusion. If it's 10%, it's not significant enough to say that, okay, this is nullified. But if it's 90%, it's another story.
Then reject the results.
Then you can voice the opinion. You mm-hmm. don't have the rights, but with proof. If you're not there, you don't have any proof. Mm-hmm. You have just opinion. Yeah, thank you. You leave the military government or whoever has the influence for this election a good time. Leave them to have whatever, to do whatever they can do, because there is no other voice, credible voice, to go against me. I think it would be all wrong.
And if one were to find the election results to be, say, scientifically 90% showing signs of being rigged, where would that, as someone who has been such an advocate internationally of engagement, of talking, of dialogue, what would then be those next steps of the international community of Thailand if it was determined after the fact by people on the ground to be something that certainly was not free and fair?
I will not speculate. Okay. Sorry. I know you like to have, you know, all the solution always to the end. It depends on what you find. Mm-hmm. If you see in any area at all, military with weapons coming out, intimidating people, then okay, hey, no more. This cannot be an election. But if you don't see that, you see, you know, you don't even have one evidence that would dictate the people that go into the ballot box to tick without their name on it, but tick the ballot box, the people they want to choose. If you tell me that, oh, this is rigged and it's all not good, should not recognize it, I would say, you know, crazy. You don't have evidence. Mm-hmm. Evidence is everything. It's important.
What about the evidence of certain political parties and individuals that from the start are not allowed to participate?
That's another story. It depends on the law. If they break the law, we have cases in Thailand. We have cases in many other countries. We have cases in Europe. But if they break the law, they're barred from being, you know, candidates. Mm-hmm. And it's the law of the country.
I think
who are you to judge?
I think there's an open question right now as to exactly what is the law in Myanmar and who is enforcing it, because
based on what I've heard, there's several cases where it's not clear if the law was broken, okay? But the person became persecuted. And why didn't the international community say anything stronger until now?
That's a very fair question.
They should have done.
Absolutely.
If they mean well for Myanmar and the country. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very fair question. I think the international community has more than let down the Myanmar people. And I think this also goes into, you know, I understand that you've also been critical of ASEAN's non-interference policy. And I wonder if you could say a bit more about that.
I would not use the word non-interference. Mm-hmm. I stress engagement. Mm-hmm. Non-interference is interpreted incorrectly in many circumstances. Engaging with them, but not interfering with, not messing with the choice of the people. There's so many engagement, there's so many countries. They try to get you to do what they're familiar with and not quite necessarily be the right formula for the country. I've seen that many times, engaging with so many countries. Okay? So I would say that if you engage with the country with a clear mind and clear interest of the people in your head, not your interest, not because you said this, you can be on the front page at your home country. Yeah, I've done that. No, come on. That's not good politics, okay? So you mean well for the people of the country. You can voice your concern on anything bad you see, anything right or not right that you observe, and tell the world about it. And I'm sure even military government or otherwise, they would, if your voice, if you have enough evidence, if you have the voice that means well for the people, it shows tremendous sincerity, you'll be heard. People will listen. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So then in amending that from non-interference to non-engagement.
To engagement.
Right, that you're critical of non-engagement and yeah. that you're a proponent of engagement. To whatever degree you've been following ASEAN and Thailand's engagement or non-engagement with Myanmar in the last 5 years, how would you evaluate that? What would you say about that?
You know, when we say that we don't engage, it does not mean we don't engage. That's the culture of Asia. You don't do things to make your friends lose face, but you talk with them informally, behind the scene, behind closed doors. It does not always mean what you see on the surface. Mm-hmm. We always engage. And when you say non-interference, there's so many cases we pretty much interfere, but not interfere, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's certainly a distinction between the outer perception and the inner workings. And there could be an outer perception that certain international systems or multilateral relations just simply aren't working, that no progress is being made. And the inner workings, there could be some kind of discussion or in your words, engagement that's going on. It can sometimes be hard to square away when atrocities continue to be committed on a daily basis, as we're seeing in Myanmar. And so, I don't know, you know, we're speaking about a contemporary issue. You've been out of public office for some time, so I'm not sure how much you're up on these or that you're involved. But from what you have seen or what you have heard about this kind of Asian way of engagement, of talking behind closed doors so that one's neighbors doesn't lose face. Do you think that it's been enough? Do you think that there are other ways to try to engage, to bring about a better result from, you know, a country we see that's being torn apart by food insecurity, by mass exodus, by conscription, by, you know, the violence that's undertaking it?
You can always improve what you do. Okay? But I've seen more than good enough results of the way ASEAN engage among others, among each others. I've seen good enough results, which many countries in the West do not understand, because that's not what you are, that's not what you do. Mm-hmm. depends on the situation, specific situation. You can always do more. But, you know, lacking specific, I cannot pinpoint to anything that I would suggest. But I have saved hundreds of people, okay, in trouble, but not shouting at the country. Not by shouting at the country, but by talking to them. And I can manage to do that in 3 days, 7 days. If I start shouting, maybe those guys will be there in 3 months in jail. Mm-hmm. It's proven. I don't need anyone to tell me to do otherwise, because I have done it and it works. So maybe the West could learn a few things from Asia, from ASEAN.
Certainly. Yeah. I think that that Southeast Asia has many lessons to share. And this is definitely a, you know, our own platform is one that's built on the beliefs of dialogue. We wouldn't be having 1 hour conversations with the people we do if we did not believe in the power of engagement, the power of dialogue. I've often said that, you know, civic discourse is a cornerstone of democratic values. I'm certainly not the first to say that. And I think that when you look at some of the problems happening in my own country, I think the breakdown of being able to have civic discourse and the attacks of free speech by both the left and the right, I think have left us in some of the severe places we have. And so, you know, from the standpoint of our platform, I often say, I'll talk to anyone. I want to know people's views. I'm not trying to speak, and this is coming more from my angle, I'm not trying to talk to someone to convince them of my argument or to come to some agreement or resolution at the end. I'm talking because I am insatiably curious about what they think and why they think it. And sometimes those views end up kind of shaping and shifting where I'm at, what I think. And sometimes they just refine a bit more the arguments that I have and make me a bit more confident and comfortable in what I believe and why I believe. But the nature of discourse is what brings that. Talking to people that, you know, talking to people that agree with you, often whatever it is, that agreement is, it often radicalizes those beliefs. Talking to those who disagree and have different views, it sharpens the intellect. So I'm, you know, coming from this platform standpoint, that is certainly, we are certainly a big believer in that. And, you know, we would, if anyone from the military would ever speak to us publicly on what they are doing, what they believe and why they're doing it, we would certainly have those conversations and try to understand it. I think, you know, again, where the challenge comes into play is where discourse and engagement and communication, these values that I hold as, you know, sacred and noble, to be honest, where they come into play with this sense of legitimization and photo ops and official recognition and some of the others. And so and the military's history as an unreliable actor, as an organization that is very shrewd at knowing how to play the international community and short attention spans and everything else, you know, how does one navigate the ability of being able to engage and to push sometimes with that engagement and not be taken advantage of by a regime that has been, you know, all too skillful at knowing how to do that. So, you know, and I think that at least from outer perceptions, the lack of progress that we've seen and the violence that has taken shape and the resolutions, you know, to any degree from even things like humanitarian, you know, it has been concerning. And so I think it does leave us in this place of looking at, you know, what does constructive engagement without legitimization look like? And I don't have an answer for that, but I think it is a legitimate tension that does have to be held up in looking at, you know, the dangers of simply not engaging or talking whatsoever, and the dangers of talking to a point where nothing gets done, but you're showing them as a reliable partner, and where that middle ground is.
You have to strike a balance. And you try to engage with anyone with a podcast in front of them, not all of them will feel comfortable. But try to talk to them without having to legitimize anything, just but just to understand how they think. Maybe you find some good answers. You know, many people censor yourself because of your thoughts, of your belief. I try not to do that. I still do that from time to time, but I try hard not to do that. So I keep my mind open. I keep all options possible. And I discuss, make sure they know that I have good intention towards them. Not a threat. Mm-hmm. Like that, people will continue to engage with you.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. Now, you were also involved for some time, and you've mentioned this, but I want to prompt you a little further on it, on the Council of Asian and Liberal Democrats, CALD, which yeah. we also spoke to Lito Arligi, who had from the Philippines, who referred us for this interview, and he gave a fascinating discussion on our podcast about CALD's engagement pre-2015 in the work that was done in helping the NLD, especially in being able to understand the elections in front of them, and spoke, you know, at length about the pre-2015 process and the post, which was fascinating and also tragic because the Rohingya genocide happened afterwards, and you know, Lito spoke about the when communication engagement started to falter. But I want to pick up on the work of CALD, because you served as Secretary General, and just to share being in that role and the work that you did, what can you tell us about that time and its significance and impact?
At the time, we worked a lot with NLD, to my recollection, and we gave them even, I would not call training, but actually examples of what we do in other countries, mm-hmm. even for campaigns, how we design the public policy that might be, you know, useful for them. We even try to get NLD to apply as not to change from observers member to be directly a member of CALD at that time. Okay, and that's why we engage with them. We engage with the leadership there. So it was, I believe it's useful from our perspective, from CALD's perspective. We've done what we can, but we cannot dictate what they should do. That's democracy. So we wish that they pick up from us that there's also several training sessions, even the public policy design sessions that they attended. They sent people to attend, and that was useful based on, you know, their response after the training sessions. And they seem pleased. But, you know, be that as it may, there came the elections and the result was known. That's democracy at work. It's the best we can.
Sure. And when you're looking at this question of engagement, whether it's with it's the turn that the NLD took, or in 2017, or whether it's the military, is there ever a line that becomes too far? Is there ever a line that's crossed where one has to take a different action than engagement or dialogue?
Once you start drawing the line, you're blocking yourself. Mm-hmm. For innovation. I never draw myself a line.
So just keep coming back, keep coming back.
I keep coming back, mm-hmm. but being sincere. You don't do any of that for yourself. You do all that for them, for the people of Myanmar. If you get your head clear like that, you don't get confused. Back to confusion again.
Mm-hmm. Right, certainly.
You don't get confused. Mm-hmm. If your intention is right and genuine and sincere, mm-hmm. and practical, not theoretical.
Mm-hmm. And now then, looking at the humanitarian needs in Myanmar, there's also been a question of a humanitarian corridor that given the long border that Thailand shares, and looking at how to get humanitarian aid into parts of the population that are being served more by non-state actors that the military wouldn't reach. What are your thoughts on that?
The whole world should do more.
Certainly, okay? Yeah.
That's so many NGOs that went there just so they have enough photo opportunities so that they can raise more funds. I even know the former president of Oxfam who struggled to raise funds, you know, to do what is right for human beings, humanitarian aspects. If all government of many big countries and small countries understand why you do this and what you do this for and who would benefit from it, you will not be reluctant to support. So far, there is not good enough support from member states that are fully accountable to the problem. It's not Thailand's problem. It's a global issue. It's a big challenge for Thailand. We have to bear all of this burden and cost alone most of the time. You know how hard time we have even to place some of the people who wants to go to the third country?
Yeah.
We don't get support, enough support. Although those countries tell publicly their people in their home country that they play that role in supporting. Mm-hmm. So the reality is exactly that. Mm. I speak based on my personal experience. At the time, I was in the office. And what I can only do is to encourage countries to do more for the best interest of Myanmar people, not yourself, not your political image. If you do that, everyone is better off. Well, I think the whole world is, there's so many hotspots around the world. And unfortunately, you know, people not paying enough attention. For those who pay enough attention, they don't have enough means. Mm-hmm. To do it. That's unfortunate. But think positive. We can always do more. We can always engage with people. The recipient side and also the donor side. We have to engage more with all of them. But persuading all sides with the right reason, not political gains. I've seen too many politicians doing all this for political gains, and that you don't achieve what is good for human beings in so doing.
Before we sign off, I want to take this opportunity to sincerely thank those of you who have chosen to contribute to our wider Better Burma nonprofit mission. In addition to supporting our humanitarian work, we simply could not continue to provide you with the content and information through our podcast channel without the wonderful support of generous donors, listeners, and friends like you. Each episode provides access to one more voice, one more perspective, one more insight. Every donation of any size is so greatly appreciated and helps us to continue the mission. So we take this time to say thank you. To find out how you can contribute, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation. Yaranangaya unyana dadu yadanam yadiganeza dimana wigara besayana besayo hoba yaranandada yananangana yaranayada yaranam podaba yaranam.